Welcome Bill Bradfield up. He is the flood insurance outreach specialist with FEMA. And Tim, we might be picking on you too. So let me just get slides up.
Hey, come here.
You
want the
mic? I think we're good
at understanding here, but feel free. Yeah, I'm not. So, hi, everybody. I'm Tim Keaton. I'm the National Flood Insurance Program Coordinator. Glad you meet. I have. So, we have every community in the state of West Virginia participates except 5 communities. Those 5 communities are all in hilltops, small communities, low population. They've been offered to join the program many times. We have over 57 CFMs. We're currently got a 273 scheduled for next month. We're also offering the CFM 10, so if anybody is interested, come schedule or get on the schedule. Other than that, Bill's going to talk about Rest Rating 2.0.
Thank you. Yeah, very informal, so if you have anything, just, you know, let's shout it out as we're going. But the whole idea is we're hoping now, with Risk Rating 2.0, which has been a big programmatic change in the flood insurance side of the NFIB, took effect. And I was hoping to provide some updates because October will be about a year into the first phase of the implementation. Unfortunately, we're having a difficult time getting data. I don't know if you've seen the news. The only data that's out there is that policy numbers are dropping. And there's a couple different reasons, but now FEMA's not even really reporting because they want to go back and look at their analytic system. So I can't really provide anything in terms of what we're seeing trend-wise, but I thought I'd use this opportunity maybe to look at some other data sets just to kind of see where we're at. And I apologize, I broke a cardinal rule of PowerPoint that I put too much data on a slide. It looked great on my screen, and I wanted to give every county shake here, but I was able to pull the loss statistics for flood policies to the NFIP for the calendar year. So I ran this on Friday. So this would incorporate any of the recent claims, probably from the flooding in July, maybe August, if they put the claim in already. But no surprise, it's sorted by the number of losses, what we've seen. So it's Keweenaw County at the top with 73, by far the most. Then it goes down to Mingo, is that Monica? Thank you. I was like, wow, that looked like a Monica Hill, I'm from Pennsylvania. Logan, Cable, and Wayne. So,
and all 5 of those communities have recently had a flooding issue.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if that helped raise them to the top. What is interesting that I also saw, though, is I kind of... There's net building payments and contents payments, not to get too crazy on the insurance side. Kanawha County by far has 2 million payments in the past calendar year. Mingo is second, or I'm sorry, I didn't sort this over here. But then you come all the way down, 844,000 to Wayne, but it only had 15 losses. So it tells me that it had fewer, but they were big. So I just wanted to put this on, so if you do get the slides or whatever, you kind of look at the data. Is this kind of what the state is seeing in terms of where the flooding's been and where the losses are? The other thing that I thought was interesting to point out here is the ICC payment. So every NFIP policy has an increased cost of compliance rider that comes with it. And if you are declared substantially damaged, which is 50% more damage than the fair market value, you can access this $30,000 for mitigation measures. No one has taken advantage of that. So there could be a couple reasons there.
I can tell you.
Yeah, I probably have a feeling I know, but I don't want to say.
I'll say it. Because they're not doing substantial damage calculations.
That's what I thought.
So we are working on getting a substantial damage team. This was something that Chuck started when he was the NFIP coordinator. We've received the equipment to do it with, and it's just a matter of getting some co-workers to help with this. So eventually we will be doing substantial damage calculations by teams, and we'll share them across the state. So it will eventually be done much better than it is today.
Sure. And that's, West Virginia is by no means alone in that. It's a challenge for, many states of Region 3 and beyond. This can be a difficult conversation to have. after an event, because not only have they lost a lot, then to go and tell them that they have needed to not only rebuild, but to rebuild compliantly. So I understand the challenges there. However, I feel that when substantial damage determinations are not getting done and folks can't access that money,
they're missing out.
They're missing out on that opportunity. They're paying for it, so they, you know, why not give the opportunity?
That could also be their match for their mitigation grant as well.
Are you talking about elevation or what?
Yes. Yeah. Basically, once you hit that threshold, it's treated like a new structure. So how would you do new development in the floodplain? You know, we need to elevate it above the base flood elevation. Same case here.
Is that like $30,000?
It's $30,000 right now. There's been discussions to increase that because $30,000 would get very far, but it is something. But
that's where I'm going to go.
Right, what does 30 bits?
Yeah, but the problem is once you're declared substantially damaged, you still have to bring it into compliance.
Whether you have insurance or not.
Whether you have insurance or not,
yes.
And Tim, what did you say about the match? Can you repeat that?
So the ICC coverage, if you are declared substantially damaged, can be used towards your mitigation grant application match.
Which is great, kind of coming off of.
Especially now that we may not have a match to offer to our people.
Right, I just want to make sure
everybody heard. If you're looking at a local map, right, if it's $100,000 elevation, that $30,000 from the property owner could be the local match that it takes out.
Bill, another issue with ICC, and this is across the board, and I'm not picking on insurance agents as a whole, but is they don't understand. A lot of their insurance agents don't understand about ICC increased cost of compliance. Out in the foyer, we have brochures about increased cost of compliance, but we're finding universally a lot of their insurance agents don't even understand about it. Increased cost compliance, and it is actually built into your policy. It's like free money that homeowners as a large generality do not know exists on their policy. So it's we have been pounding the message in the streets, trying to get folks to understand, especially communities, exactly what Tim just spoke to, that it can go towards that match, which Kelly has brought up the challenges this morning. But it's a combination of the homeowners and the insurance agents really not being aware. It's not like widely told when they go in to get their insurance policy. And if you look at it, lots of times it's like way down in the fine print. But it's a very useful tool and underutilized, I believe. So,
I'm just going to repeat that in case people on Zoom didn't hear Betsy Ranson saying that a big issue is that both insurance agents and homeowners are unaware of the increased cost of compliance. It's either they don't understand it, they're not told, they don't see the fine print in their policies, but it's kind of that lack of knowledge and understanding that is causing this as well.
And it's a really simple process to get. If the community goes in and does their calculations and declares the structure to be 50% damaged, the community writes a letter to the property owner. The property owner takes it to their insurance agent. The insurance agent submits it to the NFIP. They get their money. They can mitigate their structure at that point. It's not rocket science.
Yeah, Dusty, go ahead.
Tim or Bill, does it increase the premium? To have an ICC
lawyer. No.
The question was if it increases the premium.
But now you got to remember, the risk rating 2.0 just started this year, and nobody has had a full rate unless they just bought a new policy this year. They will get increases over the next 5 years, no more than 20%.
Yeah, 15 to 18 usually, yes.
So until they get that risk rating policy or premium. So.
But all policies have ICC. They're paying for it already. So, but it starts with that. One, the knowledge, knowing that you can do it. And two, getting the substantial damage determination done in a timely manner after an event.
And I can tell you, every time we have a flooding event, I'm on the phone with the floodplain managers, reminding them of substantial damage calculations and ICC for those that have flood insurance. I push it for those that have flood insurance. It's really hard for a community to enforce it on someone who doesn't have flood insurance, because then it's out of their pocket.
Was there another question back here?
Yeah.
No, I was just thinking about the Huntington flood that we had recently and the numbers there. And when we were out there, I don't know if this shows anywhere, like, what floor that the flooding was on, because when we were out there, everyone was, the basements was the name that was flooded. And but they claimed everyone else, all their neighbors had flood insurance. But if all their neighbors had flood insurance, they did not apply for anything in the basement.
So basements doesn't count? So limited funding for basements for three flood insurance? The only thing that's covered in a basement is your utilities, limited storage, and the rules and regulations say limited storage access to your first floor and utilities. But utilities shouldn't be there anyway. So most likely if they have a basement, they're a pre-firmed structure because basements aren't allowed in floodplains.
Any other comments, questions before we keep going?
And I will say, I just got off the phone with Bree yesterday in the city of Huntington, and she's wanting to do a mitigation public application period. And she does have one structure that she does believe is substantially damaged, so we'll be working through that process.
Is it insured?
It was insured.
Great. Yeah, and one thing, just before we move off of this one, you can empower people to know that they have ICC, force them to go to their agents. I know after Ida last year, we talked to some folks that said, I wanted to be declared substantially damaged so I can access my ICC, so then we had to reach out and remind the community, by the way, not only are you supposed to do it, but you need to do it because these folks want their money. They kind of force it from that side. So.
And I've had that conversation with several people in Campbell's Creek and Kanawha County just recently.
Okay.
I think that's what I was thinking, Tim, just the educating people, because I know they have basements because we walked in the basements, and I know that their utilities are down there because their utilities are being replaced.
Well, but, you know, here's the funny part about federal rate, not to knock down FEMA or anything, because we all overnumbered me today. But for a structure that's been damaged by flooding, if it's a pre-firmed structure, we can't require them to elevate their utilities. That's ridiculous. I mean, what's the goal of the program? To keep from repetitive flooding, repetitive damage. The rates doesn't help us.
Well, in risk rating 2.0 now, that is a mitigation credit. You will be credited for raising your utilities. It's a small one, but it's there. And it wasn't there before, so
yes.
It wasn't an incentive to mitigate, because if you raise your utilities out of pocket, your insurance premium will stay the same. You will now get a reduction if you are able to prove your mechanicals and, you know, everything is above.
If your claim is substantial damage, don't you have to then meet new codes?
Yes, it has to be brought into.
Does specify that in a floodplain you have to be above.
It has to come into compliance with today's.
You have to come into compliance if you go through that route.
Absolutely, with whatever the ordinance is.
The question was,
I'm not sure what. If you
claim substantial damage, you have to come into compliance with the new books.
So
yeah.
Which would mean elevating your utility, bringing them out of the basement, and if you're going to stay in the floodplain.
Right.
How are you going to stay there? And the problem you've got now is that with remapping that's taking place through FEMA, FEMA is now increasing the floodplain areas for many areas that weren't formerly in a floodplain. So you're going to have more homes that are going to be in floodplains now than were before.
So let me explain that to you. So FEMA did LIDAR statewide. We now have 2-foot contours, 1-foot elevations. So it's not that the floodplains are lighting. Is that we have better data than we've ever had before. The old burn maps was built off of 20-foot contour maps that was begged, borrowed, and stolen from other agencies back in the 60s. So the new LIDAR does make some floodplains go bigger and some go smaller.
That's definitely a good segue.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Our virtual audience isn't seeing the slides all of a sudden, so I just want to make sure we can fix up for them real quick.
Sure.
Did you reshare?
I'm trying.
One of the challenges, too, is that when we talk about substantial damage, we've had a disaster. And I understand that, the area.
Thank you.
It's been in the floodplain ordinance. Everyone's adopted it. It's there. It's, you know,
thanks.
Really folks are unaware, or just, you know, it's a difficult conversation to have, but.
Does the substantial damage start with the insurance adjuster or with the homeowner?
It is done by the community.
Just to repeat the question, it was asked if substantial damage was done by the homeowner or the insurance adjuster, and really said it was by the community.
Yes, after each disaster or flooding event, the communities have a responsibility to do substantial damage calculations on the house structure who had a flood or was in a flood.
So when you're saying community, you're essentially talking about a county government agency.
County or municipal. Yeah,
whoever's jurisdiction.
So if they don't have anybody on staff, we can have somebody who's also in the jurisdiction.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wearing multiple hats, yeah.
Yes, capacity, 100%. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that that's the substantial damage plan you're talking about. But it's looking to build that capacity beyond. Because, you know, if you have one person in the county who's responsible for it, but you have multiple areas across that county that get flooded,
it's difficult for one person to do it all. So we're trying to get teams together to go to this county that has recently flooded to help them in that process. Because it's a violation if they don't do it and it's not documented. So it just fits in a violation by having a team.
In your ordinance, they will have somebody who's assigned to get the power of the book like manager. They have to have some staff to participate in the program.
One person.
One person. So these teams have been very successful in other states, and will be successful here in the future. Another thing is to just believe in it. That's what I found when I'm doing substantial damage assessment across the country. If you have staff who believe in it or are willing to put themselves out there and like commit to this, they can have these difficult conversations. It makes such a difference if you have to come back. And I've been on the other side where you come back the second year and now they've lost lives, they've lost the mementos, they've lost things that could have been saved the first time if someone had just been willing to have that conversation. And sometimes it's just education, like some of the utilities, some basic things, but just basic education could have prevented people from having such challenges second time around. But you know, you have to empower the people who believe in what they're doing, otherwise it's not going to get done.
Yeah, just to repeat, the people on Zoom couldn't hear, PC was saying that not only having the capacity, that's super important, and the staff in place, but also having people that believe in the mission of this and, you know, can really advocate for it is helpful to move forward.
Yeah. No, it's a good discussion. Glad I kept that column.
Yeah,
I think that's really what we're talking about with, you know, NFIP.
Just had a quick question on the unknown houses 22. How does it show up as an unknown? Do they not submit a county name with that, or?
Yeah, it may just be a reporting error. Yeah, it could be anything. It may be the policy is from out of state. You know, so the property's in state. We see that with a lot of this data. But it could be any number of things. I just want the numbers to add up, so I kept it in there.
Understood.
Sure.
And when you're able to, you know, I know there's issues getting the restrictions kind of that, but like, how will that new data impact these numbers? Like, how do you see it changing?
It really shouldn't. I think we just wanted to kind of get an idea of what are we seeing in terms of policy numbers from risk rating 2.0. So back in October of 21, it was implemented for all new policies. So if you didn't have one before and you were getting a policy for the first time, you came in under the new rating system. And then starting April of 22, anybody renewing over the next calendar year would now be rated under the new. So we're well into it. And we were kind of hoping to see what are some of those trends now that we're fully into the new rating system. I have the request out there, but I just haven't gotten the data. But I think we'd like to see that. Do we see spikes around flooding events? I know there's been a lot of news lately about nationally the number of NFIP policies is going down. What does that mean? It could be partially reporting. It could be the fact that, you know, I've heard also that it was kind of anticipated as this new rating system came out, people who weren't as high risk, who aren't in a high risk area that were paying too little are now being rated at their actual risk and have increased, but since there's no mandatory purchase requirement, they dropped it because it was too much. So some attrition was expected, but there may be a rebound after they get flooded. So it's too early to really tell long-term trends. We're hoping to do a little bit.
So just this morning, I spoke with a gentleman, and I won't call any names, but he had submitted to find out premiums for his home, and he's not in a floodplain. Private sector gave him a quote of a little over $400, The NFIP gave him a quote of over $2,100. So you can tell that if you go private, it's probably cheaper. That's probably why NFIP policies are dropping.
The fact that NFIP requires the payment up front for the whole year, that is a big, if you're on a fixed income, you aren't going to afford the new rating that comes in. One big change they can make to the NFIP is to allow for a payment system, pay every quarter or something like that. And that would increase dramatically the number of policies that you have out there. But right now, as it stands, that isn't happening, and that's the main reason that people, especially people who don't have a federally backed loan, will let their insurance drop, because it's a matter of whether you have flood insurance or whether you feed your kids.
Sure, and I know that has been addressed. They want to, with an NFIP reauthorization coming up, it's not just reauthorization, but there's a wish list, whether or not that can be acted upon, but I totally agree with that. Yeah,
that's been in discussion for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
Even at ASFPM, it's been discussed.
How difficult would it be to have a state-funded subsidy program for flood insurance? Because, I mean, in reality, would that not save the state ultimately going forward, that it becomes an insurance issue rather than the legislatures and the governors trying to find the resources in order to mitigate future damages?
Sure. And I know that FEMA is looking at it from an affordability framework as well. With the risk rating 2.0, it's called equity in action. There's two parts of that. There's one, making the new ratings engine based on sound data and insurance and providing that full risk, moving away from the old binary system of in or out, up or down. But the other part of it is, all right, not only making the program more sound, but also now more affordable for the reasons we've talked about. They're working on that. I don't have an answer, but yeah. State ownership, almost like for revolving loan or something for, we talked about for mitigation. I don't know about the insurance side.
I think a big equity piece is the whole, payment structure or something like that really allows more people to afford it if they can pay monthly or quarterly instead of upfront.
Sure. And a lot of our message, too, is, we're NFIP, but flood insurance. If it's private, NFIP, that's fine. I mean, we know about the NFIP more because we have the data and we can, see how the sausages made, say. But, if someone wants to get private insurance for $400 versus $2,100, it's insurance. It's better than having nothing, so by all means. Sure. Go ahead.
Does the private sector use something like risk rating 2.0 in their, algorithms? Is it, the same thing?
The question was if the private sector uses something similar to risk rating 2.0 to calculate their rates.
Yeah, and we don't really have the visibility on that one, but the impetus behind risk rating 2.0 was to have the ratings engine more closely mirror what is going on in the private sector, and they've actually, are using some of those algorithms and rating engines. We contracted with them, so it's much more in par with the industry standard.
Yeah.
So maybe
I will say, if you do get that private policy and you have a flooding event, there's a possibility that policy will be canceled. I have never heard of an NFIP policy being canceled by the NFIP.
Is it because the private insurer no longer wants to cover?
Well, I remember back in 2003 in the McDowell County flooding, there was people that had flood insurance. They got their claim, and it was a State Farm flood policy, and then it was automatically canceled. They can no longer get that policy back.
Another downside, I would think, with the private sector, I'm just guessing, is still fight you a little bit more, probably, on your payout, right? I bet homeowners claims in the past, it's been, hard to get my money, right? And they're really nickel and diming you.
I don't see that on the NFIP side. I mean, usually whenever... So I always tell people that if you want to get back 100% after a flooding disaster, carry flood insurance.
Right.
because disaster assistance is to make you livable, not to bring you back 100%. Flood insurance will do that, and especially in an NFIP policy, because it pays really well.
Yeah, and I think, so I was on a call with one of my colleagues from Region 10 yesterday, or out in the West, and he's actually fighting crime right now, because a lot of folks are not getting paid in a timely manner and are fighting their claims. I don't want to say that that's the general trend, but it's enough that he's actually having to deal with it, even though we don't really deal with private, that he's hearing a lot of, you know, I flooded, the folks with the NFIP are already paid out, private folks is fighting. Some of the other things, you know, with private, is, you know, from a mitigation standpoint, you know, some of them are starting to carry something similar like ICC, but, and they do have some minimal standards, but, you know, it's not NFIP.
You're not getting those incentives.
The incentives, the mitigation grant side. And as I mentioned, the big one is getting dropped. You know, I mean, it's, you know, you'd like to think that insurance is there to help you, but they're there also make money. So if you come in at 400 and then you make a claim or two and they realize, wow, you're much higher risk than we thought, you can be dropped. NFIP won't be dropped. Policy, you know, won't go up.
The affordability issue, to bring us right back to that, West Virginia has an inordinate number of pre-firmed structures, which means they're subsidized.
Not anymore.
Were.
Not anymore.
Were. I said were.
Yeah, right. I got you.
Because they were subsidized, West Virginia, when bigger waters first came into effect, West Virginia was hit really hard with it.
And because bigger waters kind of opened their eyes, our legislative, I should say our congressional folks, actually did the second one, which was to bring down the amount that could be charged per year, 5% or something like that.
Yeah, the homeowner's flood insurance.
Yeah.
Affordability.
Yeah. And that was a big push from our congressional representatives because of the inordinate number of pre-firm structures that were subsidized. Were. what I see happening with this is twofold. You're going to have a lot more dropping because our population is aging, which means they're on fixed income, which also means that their rates are going to go through the roof because they're pre-firm and minus rated.
Mitigate.
We're still limited in mitigation funds too. I mean, you can, you know, when your disaster is only 800,000, you're not going to mitigate that much with that.
I understand. Right, you pay off your mortgage.
Right.
Off the federal mandate, yeah.
Should we keep going?
Sure, yeah, and we can go through these next couple slides. So, we wanted to throw a couple up because I know there's some recent mapping meetings, so I can let Tim speak to that. But I think, you know, probably where we're looking in terms of this discussion over here is, you know, for Kanawha County, there's, you know, almost 15,000 estimated structures. Of those, you know, 1,400 have policies, which is not uncommon. But the new maps, you know, put 250 structures in, but took 345 out. So, you know.
The map revision is a big deal.
Oh, yeah, it always is. As Tim mentioned, they're better. You know, you're using LIDAR, you know, updating the models. You know, it's not always perfect. You know.
It's much better now than it's ever been. But these dashboards, this is a dashboard of the community. So we pass these out at each one of our map mod meetings or our mapping meetings just to give the community an idea of what goes on in their community as far as flood insurance, those that are in the floodplain or the special flood hazard area, and those who are not, in the comparison between the ones that are insured and the ones that are not insured.
You can go to the next one, too.
Yeah, sometimes we can break those down further. We'll have countywide, and then we can break them down by, you
municipal.
Know,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So the municipals get their own dashboard, and the counties get their dashboard. But it's really good information for the community to see what actually is taking place in their community.
Yeah. Similar here, we also have, you know, party, 820 in the special flood hazard area. 205 get in, 255 come out. But I also realize the challenge there is that you're not going to hear from these folks.
Right. But you are from those folks.
So, yeah. We can talk about favorable numbers, but it's not favorable if you're in there, so I can understand that. I always like to throw this up there to talk about value of insurance. I know it's a little bit dated, but one of the things that's based off of individual assistance, which comes after a presidential disaster declaration, we don't get that many. So that's why the data is a little bit older. But right here, the average individual assistance payout from the 2016 West Virginia flood was $7,500. The average insurance payout was $48,000. So I know, you know, we have uncomfortable discussions about insurance, but, you know, to me, this really tells you where the rubber hits the road. You know, if you just lost everything and the damage reaches the threshold to get individual assistance, what's $7,500 going to do?
So even if you were totally destroyed in a presidentially declared disaster, FEMA can only give you up to $37,000, and I think it's $500. If your structure washed away, that's the most they can give you by law. If you have flood insurance, you can rebuild to 100% if you are 100% covered.
All right. And I apologize, I couldn't do just a snapshot of West Virginia, so I've got mixtures of other states in there. But this is what we call penetration rates in the special flood hazard area. So this is how many policies do we have in the special flood hazard area versus the number of structures. Here's the breakdown, 80%, 60 to 80, 40 to 60. Not uncommon, it's pretty, you know, we're seeing elsewhere in the region, but we're sitting in the 0 to 20% with a few spatterings of the 20 to 40%. National average is around 30%. So, you know, 3 in every 10 structures at risk in the highest risk areas, the special flood hazard area, actually have flood insurance. So I just thought, you know, it's an interesting graphic to share. You know, usually not anything where.
Go ahead. That doesn't include any private flood insurance.
No, this is just NFIP. Yeah, I'd be curious. I'm not sure. You know, we're going to go around and talk to the insurance commissioners, insurance departments later on this year, and maybe get a better idea state what they're seeing from the private side. You know, is it 5 to 10? Yeah, I've heard 5 to 10% usually. The number. I don't know if you have heard anything.
Yeah.
So real quick, we've talked a lot about risk rating 2.0. So just to give a refresher, I know we presented on this a couple times, but if you're not aware, this is the new overhaul to the insurance side of NFIP. Real reason is, you know, rates are changing to reflect flood risk more accurately. We are pulling from better data. We have more information now. So we're able to better determine the unique properties of individual flood risk down to the property level. Whereas in the old rating system, there's a manual about this thick. And you would look, are you in or are you out? And then once you're there, your lowest floor, where is it in relation to the base flood elevation? And from there, you go through a couple tables and come up. It didn't take into account a whole bunch of other factors we're going to talk about. So that's why this is important. Talked about the geographic location. If you go to get a rate or a quote from your flood insurance or your insurance agent, address, give a couple of details about the house. In about 20 minutes, they should be able to get you a quote. Right, instead of having to send it off and come back and not really sure how things really happen. Obviously, some are going to see decreases while others see rate increases. I'll show you a graph about that in a second. I just threw the timeline in there. Last October, as I mentioned, it took effect for new policyholders. April 1, April Fool's Day, no coincidence. bad PR. Risk rating 2.0 took effect for existing policyholders. Flood insurance policies are renewed on an annual basis, so April 1st required it. So there'll actually be a year lag. So, you know, if your policy renewed on March 15th, then right now you're still, you know, you renewed under the old system. So this March, you'll be rated under the new one. So it'll be a full year from that April 1st date before everybody has been migrated over to Risk Rating 2.0. All right. Here's a snapshot out of West Virginia. This data is older. I will say that, you know, 13,300 policies in force, that number is around 10,800 right now. That's what we're talking about. Now, as I'm reporting other things, hopefully we'll have more information soon. But the breakdown is 17% of the policies will see an immediate decrease, so risk rating 2.0 will actually help those folks. In here, the 60%, for the, by far the largest, you're going to see a $0 to $10 per month increase. It's worth noting that all policies under the old system were increasing at around 15 to 18% because of bigger waters and, you know, trying to move everyone to the full risk and get, you know, move away from subsidies. So this 60% are seeing increases that are in line with the increases they would have seen anyway. So they probably will not see it as much yet. I mean, they're still paying more, but it's in line with what they were already seeing, so it shouldn't come as much of a shock. You know, the 15% out here is seeing 10 to 20 a month, and then 8%, $20 or more per month. So, you know, out here is probably where we're going to start to see or hear from those folks.
Is that based on claim history, or what was the, how did they drop into those slots?
No, they ran all, when they brought the engine online, they ran all the current policies through and just saw what the changes would be and then broke it down by this. So it's not based on claims, it's just the policies that are affecting. They took all the policies in the old rating system, dropped it in the new one, and saw what the change would be.
So it's just based on an algorithm, then? It's not yep. based on history?
Yeah, that's one of the challenges that we have is the old system, somewhat archaic, it had been around for 50 years, but you could point to the manual and say, this is how we determined, you know, based off of these charts. This is much more complicated, so we can't definitively say why someone's premium went up or down without, you know, trying to do, you know, reach out more a little bit to talk to the underwriters and see how they pull it from the engine.
So longevity didn't play a role either. Yeah. I mean, some, if you had a policy for 20 something years.
No. Yeah, it would just be current policies in effect. All right.
And what's, what was the maximum they could increase per year?
They capped it at 18%.
That's the maximum per year.
Per year, yeah. Yeah, as Brian mentioned, in 2012 with bigger waters, because the NFIP was so far underwater, they had so many subsidies, folks weren't paying their full, you know, actual risk, they moved everyone up to their actual risk overnight, and people went from 400 to 20,000 or something. Yeah, I mean, that's the extreme, but you went from hundreds to thousands of dollars for, across the board. So states like West Virginia, everybody knocking down the doors, they, in 2014, they passed legislation that said, look, we have to still get to the full, you know, actual actuarial risk,
right.
But instead of doing it overnight, we're going to step it up and put them on a glide path of no more than 15-18% per year.
Do you have an idea of how many years it's going to take to level out, to get people where they're supposed to be?
Between 5 and 10, I've heard.
That's what I've heard, too.
Yeah, and just kind of building off, so, you know, some of the main moving points behind risk rating 2.0, you know, individual ratings. Under the old system, if you were in the floodplain, proximity to the flooding source didn't really make a difference. So assuming all things equal, same structure, same amount of coverage, these two would have been paying an equal amount, $50 each. But we know that even though this is the 100-year floodplain, this structure is more likely to be flooded from the, you know, 5, 10, 15-year type of storm, so the chances of them making a claim are higher. So shouldn't they pay more? Risk rating 2.0 takes that into effect. So yes, both of these would still be required to carry flood insurance if, you know, because they're in the floodplain, if they have a federally backed mortgage. But in this case now, this structure is paying more than that structure because their flood risk is inherently higher, being closer to the flooding source. Another big one, now this was always a great selling point under the old legacy, I'm not going to lie. It's called a preferred risk policy. If you were out, then basically your policy, your premium was driven by the amount of coverage that you wanted, regardless of all the other factors. So this was an enticing way to get folks to come in. But if you were right across the street with no appreciable elevation change, you may be paying significantly more, even though the risk might actually be not too different other than the fact that the line goes down your street. Under risk rating 2.0, it factors in that risk, saying, hey, look, you're at a higher risk, but it's not much more because you're probably pretty close. So this is more sound. The issue that we have now is that these folks, when they're, and these are obviously not real numbers, but when this increase happens, they're dropping, or they could drop, you know. So, you know, that is a challenge, but at least we, you know, in terms of getting the program on the right foot, we know that, you know, we're basing it off of risk in these two, relatively equal risk. Big one here in terms of replacement cost value is now factored in. That was never factored in before. It makes logical sense. Coverage being the same, $100,000, premiums. This house gets paid out more because, let's just say, it's twice the size. So they're going to have twice as much damage. Now they factor in replacement cost value. So coverage is the same. They're going to pay more in premiums because of that. Higher risk, higher chance of payout. Okay. There's still credit and mitigation activities. So obviously anytime you elevate, you get credit. Reduce your premiums, proper openings, so those are your flood beds. You know, making sure that they are, you know, elevated no more than a foot off the ground. You have the right number in there. They're all built to, you know, how they should be in the regulations. And for the first time, we're now seeing elevation machinery and equipment. So we kind of talked about that earlier. So, you know, from the numbers I've seen, it's not significant, but it is an incentive to elevate if you have flood insurance to at least get that out of the basement and get it up higher. So, you know, even when you're, if your basement gets flooded every couple of years, you're spending $2,000-$3,000 to replace the water heater, the boiler, all that stuff.
So it's more expensive to have solid perimeter walls than it is to be built on piles, piers, and whatever the other one was.
Those piles of piers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's a, that would be an interesting discussion to have in terms of talking about mitigation moving forward, is the premium is for post piles of piers. So if you're elevated on the perimeter wall, you'll still get a reduction, but it won't be nearly what it was if it was post piles of piers, which I know, you know, coming from Pennsylvania too, a lot of our elevations, folks don't, you know, they don't want to lose their basement, so they want that enclosed structure because it gets cold and snowy, and so we'll see how that one goes. Once again, I'd like to have more data, but we're too early on. I know this is kind of a busy slide, but I think it's just important to show under risk rate, well, the legacy method, what were we looking at, the rating variables, what flood zone, what's the base flood elevation, what type of foundation, and are you elevated? And you're only looking at the 1% annual chance with a 100-year floodplain. Now you're looking at additional data sources. You know, not only is there federal government source data, looking at other agencies, but this commercially available third party. So, Bob, what you're talking about, looking at, like, Verisk, or I forget the name of the company, but there's a couple different engines out there. Cost to rebuild is factored in. Then here's the more rating variables. Distance to the flooding source. Is it rain or is it, you know, pluvial? So is it, you know, rainfall coming down or is it riverine? Ground elevation, first floor height, construction type. And this other broader range of flood frequencies. We're not just looking at the, you know, 100-year flood anymore. We're looking at all of those. So, you know, if you're talking about, you know, maybe the 100-year is not the big issue, but it's the 20-year or the 2-year storm or, you know, some of these stormwater system flooding. Some links in here for the slides, or for some more additional data if you want to take a look for.
Yeah, we'll be sharing all this with everyone after.
Yeah, I just kind of figured it's easy for everybody to kind of have as much information if you want to do a deeper dive as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Any other comments or questions? I know we had a really great discussion throughout, but any lingering questions or comments? And Tiffany, can you take a look at the chat and see if there's any comments from.
Nothing in the chat.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
I did want to ask something, and I hate to put you on the spot on this, Ken, but garnering support from the top down to support these programs is absolutely huge. And just for the sake of discussion, can you share the conversation you had with a homeowner in Greenbrier County where full disclosure with realtors is a key factor that needs to change.
Yeah.
If being able to educate the citizen, realtors being required to provide accurate information of properties that are being purchased, particularly when you have your brand new homeowner that is all excited about buying their first home, and they buy their home, and then because they did not do due diligence, they did not know to do that type of corporate investigation, they find out, sadly, that their home is severely in the special flood hazard area, and now they're required to recover carry insurance.
Yeah, just to repeat for folks online, Betsy was, you know, stressing the importance of this outreach and education to homeowners, and asked Tim to share an experience, recent conversation, with that. So go ahead, Tim.
So we had a citizen, a couple moved in from Virginia. They moved into White Sulphur Springs. They went through a realtor, said they bought the house sight unseen, which is something you should never do. So they moved into the house. The realtor told them, oh, the vacant lot beside them, she would build her commercial structure there because he was wanting to build, he's a mechanic, and just wanted to put in a garage so that he could continue on making money. He bought the structure, went to get a building permit for the new structure beside him and found out both structures were in the floodway. Floodway has very stringent requirements. You have to prove zero rise, and that's 0.0000. And anything you put into the floodway is going to cause a rise because you're putting something in that's taking space. So it's going to cause a rise. So now this guy is stuck with not only a house, but a vacant lot beside of him. Then all you can do with it is mow.
Yeah,
and his insurance premium is expensive, but the floodway has nothing to do with his premium. It's the distance to the stream that's getting.
Yeah, I will say, just kind of personal experience, but it's similar. My husband and I just bought a house in Maryland, and we were working with a realtor, and I had mentioned, you know, that I kind of worked in this space, and she was like, we just need more information, you know, Mark, we just don't understand what we need to be telling homeowners, we don't understand it, so how are we supposed to, you know, educate homeowners? So there's definitely that lack of knowledge and outreach to the realtors who, as a homeowner, you're putting kind of all your trust in them to guide you. But if they don't know the information, how are you going to know the information?
Well, and most people out of state don't know the laws of West Virginia. Most realtors in other states do have disclosure laws. They use the same forms as everybody else with all the disclosure stuff down the side. But they don't mark a box that they don't tell anybody nothing because if you're in a special flood hazard area, you're still on a property, and you disclose that information, you're not going to sell that property. You're just not. Because who wants to move into a hazard area?
And that's the issue. Everyone clearly has that hazard area.
Well,
it doesn't
matter.
Well, right. Yes.
But right, but it's not. Yeah.
Bad. Yeah.
But that's a big change, too. I mean, you know, I took out a lot of slides for risk rating 2.0 because I didn't want to go too in the weeds here, but you know, we're getting away from flood maps. You know, right now, under risk rating 2.0, the flood maps that you see are really only
mandatory
for permitting purposes. Who has to pick up flood insurance if they have a federally backed mortgage or not? But FEMA doesn't, we're not using the flood maps anymore to determine the risk. You know, it's a graduated risk. It's not just here or there. It's a broad swath, and you know that, and that's why we're seeing folks who are well outside the map floodplain pay a lot for flood insurance because there are a whole bunch of other risk factors on that property. Now, whether they like it or not, they're going to keep their flood insurance. That's another discussion. But we're looking at more, you know, more risk. But that was, and I'm glad you brought that up about the builders. Before coming to FEMA, I was in the position in Pennsylvania. One of our biggest outreach for risk rating 2.0 were realtors associations, just going around and pounding the pavement. We could not make inroads with the insurance agents. They didn't want to hear it. They don't really, you know, whatever. You know, they don't make a lot of money off of NFIP, so they don't push it. But the real
I disagree with that because you know what? They write that policy one time,
yeah,
but they get that money every year.
Oh no, I agree.
Policy. Yeah,
that's just what you're saying. That, like, you know, compared to all the other things they could push.
Right.
But the realtors, they have a unique relationship with the home buyer that kind of spans lenders, agents, everybody right there, and you know, and they should be advocating. Now, I've had realtors say, yeah, but when I disclose that and I lose the sale, it takes, you know, food off of my table. Okay. Fair argument. That's fine. But I think that realtors is kind of an untapped resource in terms of being able to advocate.
What's the benefit of that, though? I mean, my mortgage company, when I made an offer on a home, they said, oh, well, this is going to require flood insurance, and that gave me the opportunity to back out of the offer.
Was that in West Virginia?
Yeah, it was in West Virginia.
Wow, did she tell you that?
Yeah, I made an offer on a house, then they came back and said, oh, this lending company is requiring flood insurance in the flood hazard area. And I said, well, I'm not interested in purchasing.
Just to repeat that for those online, Tom was saying that he was given the option to back out after making an offer when he found out that the mortgage on this home would require him to purchase flood insurance.
Well, I guess
it's nice to know we have honest realtors.
It's the lender.
Okay, that makes sense because they're required to tell you.
Yeah, but what's the benefit of hiding it? Because it's going to come out at closing or at some point.
Well, and Tom, this is a good point because you were told up front.
Right.
Most people don't receive that letter until 7 to 10 days after they've signed on the line and they've already made the line.
I've had people call me in tears because they just came out of closing and found out they now have to carry flood insurance.
Well, I'm a good realtor if anyone needs
to. No, that's great. I mean, it's great to hear
that. Going to be calling his realtor.
It's great to hear that's out there, but it's that you.
It's rare.
But it's rare. Yeah.
Yes.
Well, 40 years ago when I purchased my house, my bank told me I had to have flood insurance in order if I wanted to take the loan because I was interested in getting flood insurance. But my bank also told me if you want to not pay flood insurance, get an elevation. And the elevation showed the first floor was above the flood level, so they said, okay, you don't need to have insurance.
So you got the elevation certificate.
So normally you have to get through the letter of map amendment to be removed before the bank can accept that, but you can do that, yes, absolutely.
And then 16 years later, I flooded.
And did you have flood insurance?
No.
So, you know, 40 years ago, if you did the loan and was removed, then you qualified for what's called a preferred risk policy back then. And you could have insured your house for $200,000 for as little as $300 a year.
I did.
Yes.
But it's a lot higher now.
Oh, yeah, it is a lot higher now. Yes, absolutely.
Well, so what you're all saying, we actually have a coworker who first-time home buyer, and she was told up front that she had to have the insurance, but what she wanted, I'm sure there was paperwork, but again, first-time home buyer. What wasn't told to her is that she had to pay every, you know, the whole amount at one time.
Up front.
And so, you know, that's also something that isn't occurring. It's really important for people to know I've got to come out of pocket. So, and I've heard that a lot across the board. People complain and say, well, I just can't afford to do that all up front. What am I going to say?
Yeah. I got $100 a month. It's a little bit easier than $400.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And a lot of times, if the bank determines that before you go to closure, they'll let you escrow the flood insurance and the homeowner's insurance premiums so that you pay it monthly. Yeah.
But if everything falls into place early on.
Right. And you have an honest banker.
Right.
Yeah.
But at closing, you end up paying up front money for it because they've got to be ahead on the insurance because the insurance is paid in advance.
Right.
And that's when people call. They're like, I just found out. Yeah, I need flood insurance, I need an elevation certificate, well, you're 3 weeks out from getting a surveyor out there to show you that it's not going to help you anyway. That's a bad conversation.
So quick question for you. In regards to the risk rating 2.0, you had the legacy of how was analyzed as the 1% chance of exceeding flooding compared to you have a number, and going back to what these two just mentioned is, He didn't carry flood insurance yet. He got flooded, did the Lomar or Loman?
Loman.
And so are we looking above the 1% chance of exceeding flood for risk? So say 250, 500?
I think up to 10,000.
Okay. And it just, and as you go up, I'm sure your rate decreases.
Okay, so I have not seen side-by-side
comparison,
because there's so many other factors that get brought into it, but yeah, I think that's...
Casey?
So, while we're sharing stories here, I also bought a house recently, and I was looking for houses, and I saw online someone who posted 3 times in the listing, big, bold, this is not in the special flood hazard area. 3 times. And of course, that made me go, huh. And looked it up, and it was absolutely in the special flood hazard area, right in the middle of it. So definitely right next to that river. So, you know, we don't all have Tom's or Bill's. can't trust the sellers there either. So what I heard through this discussion kind of two conversations about disclosure laws and what was it, and subsidies for flood insurance. And I was curious either for Tim or for the SRO or if any of you guys have heard of people higher than us discussing this. Like, is this a conversation ongoing or should be?
I don't know, but I have a meeting tomorrow with the Legislative Flood Committee, so we'll see what they're talking about tomorrow. Bob, have you heard anything about you?
I had a meeting with Senator Swope yesterday.
This same discussion happened, I think, the first risk reduction consultation meeting I attended years ago. So it has been brought up.
Yes.
What's been done since then? I don't know. I've not heard anything. But it has been brought up before. We've had a whole different group in the room during this discussion. Realtors, who also delegates and things like that. So it's known.
Yeah, we used to, in the first iteration of our contract that I worked under, we were planning and hosting the flood insurance roundtables. With the way our contract is scoped now, they're not under our current scope, but we would bring together insurance agents and realtors and really try and get into, you know, all of those different industries for this outreach and engagement and education. So it's definitely something to think about, you know, as we move forward and our contract moves forward and stuff, because it seems that that would be a great benefit to everyone.
Yeah. With Risk Rating 2.0, they addressed a lot of the issues with the legacy program to make it more actuarial sound, to make it a more defensible, stronger program, but now we need to fill in the back end with all the intangibles in terms of affordability and being able to escrow those kind of things. So it's still a work in progress. We had to rebuild, burn the house down, so not to go in substantial damage.
As far as the discussion, going clear back to the 2004 flood protection plan, there were recommendations
in the 2004 flood protection plan that realtors be required to disclose. So this is going back a long time, and it may continue to go on for a long time.
It is not a popular subject. But it's a necessary subject. And I'm for you, those of you that do have the ears of those folks, it would be great if you could continue to pound that message.
Yeah. You're a little too late.
What she said.
What Betsy said. Yeah, it's an important topic, but not a popular topic.
Any other comments, questions, anything in the chat for the group today?
No, it's a quiet group online.
I do have one question.
Yeah.
And this goes to what Casey was speaking to. Are there repercussions for anyone that, I guess, would falsely state that a structure is not in the floodway? Or if you ask your realtor and they say, oh, it's you're good, and they purposefully, mislead you, is there anything?
If it's word of mouth and not in writing, there's no repercussions. But if they get it in writing,
so that's
what you're legal.
That's what we should be telling people. Get it in writing.
Get it in writing.
Not.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that's a big piece of word education.
Words are worth nothing.
Going back to what Casey said, she brought such a wonderful point there, that we need to stop talking about the how much it costs. It's what is it saving us?
Right.
We have the most important investment of our lives, and we're requiring $2,000+ a year to protect that. In the scheme of things, really, it's the most important investment of your usual of your life. So if you go at the aspect of not so much how much is it costing me, but how much is it saving me when you got flooded, just like you said. Got flooded. You know, it's to me it's a no-brainer, but I do understand economically depressed states, it can be a challenge. But if we could start re-messaging about how much you are saving yourself versus how much it's costing.
Yeah,
but I do think the whole thing about being able to break it up or do it through the escrow is a huge, that would be so awesome if they could get that.
Yeah, and for those, if you couldn't hear
Betsy was saying, it's important that we, you know, shift the focus to what we're saving, rather than how much it's costing, because people see dollar signs and that's what kind of deters them. They see big, you know, a big dollar sign, whereas if it was a monthly payment or something, people just look at that as a little bit more manageable. So the messaging definitely needs to switch.
Yeah, it reminds me of the FEMA tagline. It says, can you afford to not have flood insurance?
Right.
Right.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. That's a fair question. So. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That was a great discussion. All right. Moving on to Gabe for an update on the state's hazard mitigation plan.